From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Trembling Before God is the new documentary about gays and lesbians who are Orthodox or Hasidic Jews. These branches of Judaism prohibit homosexual behavior. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Sandy Dubowski, the filmmaker, Steven Greenberg, the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi, and Michelle Miller, a lesbian who was raised in a Hasidic family. Also, with the 2002 Winter Olympics beginning next week, we'll talk about Salt Lake City's preparations with reporter Lee Benson. He's covered 7 Olympics for the Salt Lake City paper, The Deseret News. He's just published a guidebook to Salt Lake and this year's Winter Games. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush promised today that the United States will give strong support to the reconstruction of Afghanistan. The president welcomed Afghan leader Hamid Karzai to the White House, where he announced the U.S. will make a $50 million installment on its promised aid funding to Afghanistan. The president also said today that the White House will not turn over records regarding meetings between energy company officials and the administration's energy task force headed by Vice President Cheney. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
There is a great deal of interest in meetings between the task force and Enron Corporation, and the General Accounting Office may file a lawsuit this week seeking to force the White House to turn over details of the meetings. The president says the GAO has no such authority and that his ability to get candid advice is at stake.
And in order for me to be able to get good sound opinions, those who offer me opinions or offer the vice president opinions must know that every word they say is not going to be put into the public record. And so I view the GAO like the vice president does. It's an encroachment on the executive branch's ability to conduct business.
But the GAO counters that the Energy Task Force is subject to oversight because of the role it played in developing a national energy policy. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
About 14 U.S. Army soldiers were hurt today when a helicopter carrying them made a hard landing on rough terrain in northern Afghanistan. An Army spokesman said there were 24 people aboard the Chinook helicopter when it tipped over. The soldiers were members of the Army's 101st Airborne Division who are being deployed to replace Marines in the area. The injured soldiers were taken to an Army medical facility north of Kabul. Israeli police swarmed into Jerusalem today, one day after a Palestinian bomber killed herself and one Israeli on a crowded city street. One newspaper reports that sweeping security measures are under consideration. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
New checkpoints and roadblocks appeared in Jerusalem, and snipers took positions on rooftops as Israel moves to prevent Palestinian attacks in the city. Officials promised tougher scrutiny of Palestinian women after yesterday's bombing. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported on its website that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's government will consider a broad security plan that includes additional roadblocks, video cameras, and possibly even a wall between parts of East and West Jerusalem for the first time since 1967. The plan has never been implemented because of its cost and opposition from the right wing on the grounds that it constitutes a redivision of Jerusalem. Early today, a Palestinian was shot and killed by police after driving into an officer at a checkpoint outside Tel Aviv. Palestinians said the man was a car thief, not a militant. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Dow gained 25 points today to close at 9,268. The Nasdaq gained 6. This is NPR News. The head of the Arthur Andersen accounting firm said today that his company has lost business because of its involvement with the collapse of Enron. Andersen chief Joseph Berardino wouldn't elaborate on his statement at a news conference at the company's Chicago headquarters. He said his company is reviewing all of its procedures in the Enron audit. In Berardino's words, "We will know in a few days what did we know and when did we know it." Both Andersen and Enron are being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and congressional committees. Toys R Us says it's closing stores and cutting jobs in hopes of boosting profits. Doug Doyle reports from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey.
Toys R Us will close 37 of its Kids R Us stores and 27 other retail outlets. One store in Eatontown, New Jersey, has already covered its sign and cleared out the building. The closings will result in the elimination of 1,900 jobs from its stores and headquarters. The retailer says the layoffs would be from domestic stores, saying the cuts would increase cash flow this year. Toys R Us had a third quarter loss of $44 million. The company has said the slumping economy, extensive remodeling costs, and fallout from the September 11th terrorist attacks have contributed to its earnings slump. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
The European Union is threatening to impose sanctions on Zimbabwe in an effort to promote free elections in the southern African nation. EU foreign ministers demanded that Zimbabwe allow the deployment of European observers during its upcoming presidential elections. The sanctions would include a freeze on the European assets of Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, and ban him from traveling to the EU's member nations. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Trembling Before God, is a documentary about gays and lesbians who are Orthodox or Hasidic Jews. They would like to stay within their faith, but those branches of Judaism prohibit homosexuality. Orthodox and Hasidic Jews follow Jewish law, or halacha, and most don't believe the law should be adapted to suit contemporary times. There are strict rules that outline gender roles. My guests are Sandy Dubowski, the director of the film, Michelle Miller, a lesbian from a Hasidic background, and Rabbi Steven Greenberg, the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi. Here's a clip from the film that shows what these gays and lesbians are confronting. One of the men interviewed in the film, David, went to Jerusalem 20 years ago to meet with a Hasidic rabbi he held in high regard. The rabbi advised David to undergo a form of aversion therapy. For example, David was supposed to wear a rubber band on his wrist, and every time he felt attracted to a man, he was supposed to snap the rubber band. The rabbi also recommended that David eat dates and figs. In the documentary, Trembling Before God, David returns to the rabbi who gave him that advice. Here's the rabbi talking with David.
Are you still looking for ways
to change?
Yeah.
No.
You aren't.
Because I don't think it's possible. I can't have sex with women. It's just inappropriate. It's like you having sex with men. I can't. I can't do it. It's just not in me.
Unfortunately, you have to go through the heartache of being in this position, having these feelings, and coming to grips with what God has to say about it. To have sexual relationships with another man is something that's a prohibition. I don't blame you for wanting to have acceptance of something that's so much a part of your life and such an emotional part of your being.
Do I live my life alone, with no partner, with no loving relationship? Is that according to this halacha, is that the right way that I'm supposed to live my life?
Well, I've been taught that we're not given anything that we can't have control over. It may not be easy sometimes.
You're talking about sublimating my homosexual feelings to have sex with a woman? So how about I would tell you in the same vein, can't you sublimate your feelings for women and channel them into developing relationships with men?
I sublimate my feelings for women every day.
Yeah, but you channel them with your wife. You have that with your wife. What you're telling me is to put in the plug or lock the door and throw away the key. What am I gonna be, 95 years old and saying Tehillim and eating dates and doing somersaults and doing rubber bands and holding my breath and studying Gemara till I can't, you know, what? Must I live a celibate halachic existence by myself with friends? Is that my lot? Is that what I'm supposed to have in this life?
A clip from the documentary Trembling Before God. Later in that conversation, the rabbi tells David, though although he feels David should be celibate, he doesn't know if he would recommend going back to aversion therapy. Filmmaker Sandy Dubowski says therapy that tries to make homosexuals change their nature can be very damaging.
David, for example, pulled out of the film at least 6 or 7 times because he felt like this was violating Kibbutz Ava Em, which is honoring one's parents, that by being in this film, he was shaming his family. And I think that that partly was a legacy of the damage these therapies did, that it turned his homosexuality into something that he was utterly ashamed of, and still struggles, I think, to find self-acceptance.
Rabbi Steven Greenberg, you've been described as the first out Orthodox rabbi. Did you know you were gay when you became a rabbi?
Oh, no. I might have had suspicions that I was, you know, had some bisexual energy in me, but, you know, I always understood myself as a straight person through that whole process.
And when did you realize that that wasn't the case?
Well, part of the difficulty, you know, in general in gay identity is that it's a kind of a resisted creeping awareness that, you know, initially doesn't have any language, and eventually, you know, you kind of bang yourself against a reality that you deny and deny, and finally, you know, you have to deal with it. I was in my mid-30s when finally I fully understood that I was a gay person.
Now, what does your religion tell you about homosexuality?
Well, surprisingly, very little. The truth is that the verses in Leviticus that are used by many people to mark the Bible's rejection of homosexuality are, I think, misread. What's prohibited is intercourse between men, but no relationship at all between women is mentioned, and other relationships, other sexual engagements between men aren't mentioned at all. So, minimally speaking, the question is why would the Bible, the Torah, prohibit intercourse between men, but fundamentally, that's one act and not what we would call homosexuality. Were that to be the concern of the text, then relations between women would also have been concerned. So the real question is, you know, why is it that the text prohibits this one act? Homosexuality, the desire of the same sex, you know, that in itself appears nowhere in the Hebrew Bible.
But it sounds like you're unusual in interpreting the Jewish texts that way, that most of the Orthodox or Hasidic rabbis think that homosexuality, it goes against the Jewish laws.
Well, look, desire is not prohibited. That's the first thing, is an interesting point, is that desire is not prohibited, certain actions are. And once again, then when you look at the actions, you realize, well, you know, only intercourse between men is prohibited. So that in itself it challenges the rabbinic leadership to say, well, one second, could it be, and this is, of course, my view, that Western homophobia has actually shaped our position more than the tradition itself?
When you realized that you were gay and you came out, what kind of reaction did you get from other rabbis?
Well, that is actually surprising to me, because it took me an awfully long time to deal with this on my own and to fight myself. I was even engaged at a point, and I was really struggling. And finally, when I came out, you know, I expected the sky to fall, and of course it didn't. I got, you know, phone calls from colleagues that said, congratulations, but don't but don't tell anybody, I just told you that. I got letters from people who were really supportive. I got very little angry or strong-worded negative responses to my coming out. That doesn't mean that people supported it. It just means that I think in the beginning, people didn't really quite know how to respond.
Steve, Terry asked you about coming out, but I'm surprised you haven't told the story about going to the rabbi in Jerusalem.
Well, yeah. You know, I was 20 years old when I first began to really be aware of strong attractions, physical attractions to, you know, some other fellow in the yeshiva that I was attending in Israel. And I decided that I needed to understand this because it really scared me. And I went to Jerusalem and found a very, very right-wing, very pious old, you know, man who's was, you know, famed to be not only a very authoritative halachic, you know, Jewish law expert, but also a wise man. And he sat with a coterie of his attendants, and basically he spent most of his day just counseling people and answering questions. And I was ushered in and sat down, and I asked him in Hebrew, my master, I am attracted to both men and women, which is how I understood myself in the beginning. What shall I do? And he looked at me with his twinkling eyes and said to me, Yididi Yikari, my dear one, my friend. Yesh lecha koach ahava pishnayim. You have twice the power of love. Tishtamesh bazeh bezehirut. Use it carefully. So I was a bit stunned. It's just hardly what I expected to hear. And I said to him, is there anything more you can tell me? He said, no, there's nothing else to say. And his attendants ushered me out of the room. And I understood that while he wasn't permitting me to engage in a full, you know, fledged gay relationship, I wasn't asking that. I was asking about the nature of my soul, about the, you know, my inner life, like what was this ugly or not? Was this feeling, this desire, was this sickness, what was it? And he said, no, this is one of the powers of love. So that experience, while it didn't permit anything, was a marvelously supportive way for me to kind of accept that feelings could indeed be feelings of love. He wouldn't have permitted the action upon them, but at least he didn't describe them in some ugly fashion.
We're talking about the new documentary, Trembling Before God, about gays and lesbians who are Orthodox or Hasidic Jews. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are three of the people involved with the film Trembling Before God. It's a movie about gays and lesbians who are from Orthodox or Hasidic Jewish backgrounds. Sandy Dubowski made the film. Rabbi Steven Greenberg is considered the first out Jewish Orthodox rabbi. And Michelle Miller, who grew up in a Hasidic background. Michelle, you were married before you came out. Did you realize you were a lesbian when you got married?
I actually discussed it with my husband before we got married. I knew the feelings that I had before I got married were real, and that the only way that I could get out of my parents' house at the time and sort of free myself to experience life for myself was to get married, because otherwise I would not be allowed to leave their home. So the only way that I could lead a free life, really, or a life to meet my expectations and my goals, was to get married.
So you needed marriage as a launching pad for your life?
Pretty much, yeah.
And your husband was willing to go along with that, understand?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak for him. I don't think it's right or necessary. It was discussed before I got married, and he knew how I felt.
How long did you stay married?
Close to 4 years, and when my parents finally disowned me, I didn't see that it was necessary to, you know, keep that same agreement, because they were the ones that I was making the agreement for. I didn't want them to disown me, and once they had done that, I didn't feel the need to be married any longer.
Do you still consider yourself Hasidic, or have you left the community?
I will always be Hasidic. There is nobody that can take the Hasidic roots from me. They are something I'm very strongly identified with. I love my culture. I am by no means Orthodox in the traditional sense. I am reintroducing Orthodoxy into my life at this point because I have found a community in which it can exist. There are many people, such as the Orthodykes, which is a community of lesbians who come from Orthodox and Hasidic backgrounds, who get together for holidays and make Shabbat dinners and stuff like that. And it's a beautiful thing, and re-explore our from or religious roots and feel a part of it truly. Whereas when I left my family, I felt that I had to give that up because I didn't see a community in which I could practice.
Well, it's interesting to me because in Hasidic Judaism, you know, gays and lesbians clearly aren't welcome, but also women aren't quite equal. As you were saying, women are expected to be exceptionally modest, to not sing in front of men. What are some of the other restrictions on women's lives in the Hasidic community?
Well, they don't necessarily consider them restrictions when they're teaching them to you. They teach them to you as these are things that are finer and better, and your quality of life is better because you are following a certain path. And they sort of taught us that we were princes and princesses, and that, you know, we have to dress a certain way and we have to behave a certain way, and that we're part of a special class of people. You're not ordinary, common folk. You are different. And so we didn't treat them as things that were binding or things that were holding us down or things that were holding us back.
Let me ask Sandy Dubowski, who is the director of the film Trembling Before God, and Rabbi Steven Greenberg, if, you know, the movie is about homosexuality and Orthodox and Hasidic Judaism, but what about the larger role of, like, women in general in Orthodox and Hasidic Judaism?
Well, actually, in the Orthodox gay community, which, you know, is a growing kind of phenomena, there is an internal debate as to how we engage with the tradition. Do we only address the question of gay and lesbian liberation, or do we recognize that women's liberation is also a piece of this conversation? And I'm on the, I would say, the radical left fringe, because to my mind, homophobia is one small expression of the larger misogyny. Not in the text, you see, I don't see this in the Bible or in the Torah, but I see this in the way in which it's read. And so I do think that there are real challenges for us as gay and lesbian people to make sure that we're also responsible for the shaping of a fully subjective, equal voice for women. Though, Terry, I want to make the kind of, in a way, the conceptual piece clear that why I think these things are related. Because I really think that fundamentally the problem with intercourse between men is historically that it humiliates, the receptive partner by, in a way, feminizing or turning that partner into like a woman. That's why it says in male you shall not lie with the lyings of a woman, or in the way one sleeps with a woman. It is an abomination. In other words, it's very possible to understand the whole prohibition as the horror of a man behaving like or being, you know, acted upon as one does a woman. And so it is, in a way, the demotion of women generally, the problem of being a woman, or you might claim being penetrated like a woman, that is at the core of the prohibition in Leviticus. So the relationship between the struggle for parity or equality between men and women and their subjective voices and presence in the community, and the struggle for the acceptance of gay and lesbian experience in the community and partnership, these are not, they're intertwined realities that, you know, that need to be addressed together. So you sense that, and I think you're correct.
I think that everybody who feels that some of their own personal essence is rejected by their religion has to struggle with this question. Does that mean they reject the religion so that they could be themselves and live their life the way they think it should be lived? Or do they stay in the religion and try to change the religion?
Terry, there's been enormous changes. I mean, we're open in theaters in New York now for 10 weeks. Within those 10 weeks, we've gotten 15 Orthodox synagogues across New York and Long Island to co-sponsor dialogues following the film. We have rabbis, we have Hasidim coming from every neighborhood in Brooklyn to the theater. I mean, when we, on opening night, I saw these two Hasidic women exit the theater and walk towards Sixth Avenue. And I sort of chased them down the street and said, I just want to tell you that, you know, thank you for coming. And, you know, this Sunday, we're having 8 Orthodox synagogues co-sponsoring a dialogue, and I would love if you could come, and if you can't, please spread the word. And then I turned to them and I said, well, how did you hear about the film? And one of them looks at me and she says, the group. And I say, the group? And she says, the group. And I say, do you mean the Orthodykes? And she says, yes. And it turned out that she was a Hasidic lesbian who was separating from her husband with many children, and she had brought her straight friend to the theater. So I get a message on my machine that night from the friend that says, thank you so much. I really never understood what a lesbian was and why my friend couldn't just be with a man. But I see the film and I see the struggle, and now I get it. And I go to the theater next night, and there's a huge crowd of Hasidim from Muncie. And it turns out that her friend had brought her husband and, like, her many brothers and her cousin. And by the end of the film, everyone was standing around on the street, and there was this whole, you know, Hasidic group from Muncie, and there was a modern Orthodox couple who had a gay son, and there was an African-American friend of mine and Chinese friend and Reformed Jews and lesbian and gay and straight, and everyone was just, like, really speaking honestly and sharing their thoughts about the film and then opening up their lives. And the Hasidic woman's husband whipped out a camera and started taking pictures of all of us, and, you know, she mailed them to me a few weeks ago and put this note in and said, you know, Simcha, when God created the world, I believe this is what he imagined.
Well, Michelle, let me ask you if you feel like all of this change is reaching your parents, is making it any easier for your parents to reopen the door to you. They disowned you several years ago when we realized that you were a lesbian and you planned on staying that way.
Well, that's not exactly the reason that they disowned me, but it's part and parcel probably of everything. I think it was just a little too worldly thing that my thoughts were kind of different than theirs. But I do know that it's making waves in the Hasidic community, not on as grand a scale as in the modern Orthodox community, because they're slightly more insular. It will eventually get there. Everything eventually does. And if I can go back to something that we were talking about earlier, when you said, you know, do I consider the ways that I was raised to be repressing? And I don't believe necessarily in their practices, and that's why I don't practice them the same way. At the same time, I don't want to tell them that they can't do what they're doing, that it's bad, because they truly believe in what they're doing, and it's not hurting them as a community if they choose to open their minds and see that there are people that are different among them. It's when they stop looking at that and when they choose to ignore that, that they're really harming themselves most. But at the same time, I mean, they have very strong practices for a reason. I believe that if we tell them that they can't do what they're doing, practice-wise, like the way they dress and their religious observances and Shabbat and stuff like that, then we're being just as bad as they are being to us. We're being just as judgmental of them.
Sandy Dubowski directed the film Trembling Before God. Rabbi Steven Greenberg is the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi, and Michelle Miller is a lesbian who grew up in a Hasidic family. We'll talk more about the film in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Henry and Edith Everett, recognizing Teach for America, college graduates teaching in under-resourced public schools, 800-TFA-1230. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Olympic Winter Games begin next week. Coming up, we talk with Lee Benson, a reporter from Salt Lake City, who has just written a guide to his city and the Winter Games. And we continue our conversation about the documentary Trembling Before God. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Sandy Dubowski, director of the new documentary Trembling Before God, about gays and lesbians who are Orthodox or Hasidic Jews. Those branches of Judaism prohibit homosexuality. Also joining us is Michelle Miller, a lesbian who grew up in a Hasidic family, and Rabbi Steven Greenberg, the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Greenberg, did you act on your homosexuality before coming out about it?
Oh, well, yeah. I think that it's kind of difficult to imagine real self-understanding unless you begin to make sense of it, you know, emotionally and even physically. So I think that it's that took me many years. I was in my late 20s, early 30s before I began to kind of explore. And I had a, you know, even while I had originally found a boyfriend, I was still dating to get married for some 8 years. So I had begun to kind of understand myself, but had not really known what I was going to do with it for a number of years. And then finally, at a certain juncture, when I realized that there was never going to be a way I was going to make a marriage work, understanding my inner life the way I did, I began to stop dating women and started to kind of really focus on my life. And it's a very scary thing because when you grow up, I think you don't even have to be Jewish or Orthodox for this. We all imagine ourselves in a kind of life trajectory of marriage and children. And if you're Jewish, you know, I mean, this is, you know, your parents, like, you know, can't even imagine, you know, starting a sentence without, you know, this, the presumption of your heterosexuality and your ultimate marriage and you're providing grandchildren. And my mother's a survivor of the Holocaust, so it only added a level of guilt at not being, you know, kind of the first child named after my grandfather who died in Auschwitz and my grandmother who perished right after the war. So I, you know, was raised with this notion of this is, you know, this is where your life is going and what you're supposed to be doing. And I would have loved, I mean, I fantasized about being a parent when I was 15. So it's a very, you know, profound and deep sense of your future that you have to actually undermine, you have to mourn. And then add to that the Orthodox, you know, commitment to bear children and to do this, which is, you know, kind of gives it a religious frame. And I have to say that probably the hardest challenge in accepting my gayness was mourning the life that I could not have with a woman at the Shabbat table and lots of children around, and to have to begin to write a new story.
Did you ever feel like a fraud, that there you were, a rabbi, upholding certain principles, teaching certain principles of a Jewish tradition that you were violating by being gay?
I think in the beginning, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, as I said, the process of dealing with this is one in which one affirms the all rightness and then feels sick to, you know, and fraudulent. And you run back and forth between those feelings. I think what finally moved me beyond the sense of being fraudulent was the sense of integrity in front of God that the truth shapes. That there's another kind of, you know, another kind of fraudulent living that I began to see in light of the lies that I would have to tell. You know, people would set me up on dates and I would have to come up with some lie why I couldn't go out. And in the end, I began to see it as more fraudulent, much more fraudulent, to live a life of secrets and lies. And what helped with that, frankly, is my a personal relationship with God, which, you know, in my tradition, God is and loves the truth. So it made no sense for me to lie any longer. And so in a way, of course, after struggling for 15 years, no, I no longer feel fraudulent at all. That doesn't mean that I feel certain. I have to add that. That part of the human experience in front of God is to never really know what God's final will is and to always accept with humility that one could be wrong. And so I think that I know, and I, you know, I counsel young gay and lesbian people this way as well, Orthodox people. I say, listen, we all struggle to do our best in light of the divine will that we perceive and are taught. But in the end, we all stand naked in front of God, tell our story, and accept God's judgment.
Do your parents talk to you?
Oh, yes, sure.
So this very close with my coming parents. Out has not ended your relationship with your parents?
Well, it's very hard for my folks, and particularly for my mom, but no. And it's, you know, strangely enough, the relationship with my partner has helped very much because my parents see me happy. They see someone who loves me very much and who, you know, takes care of me when I'm not feeling well. And my mother feels just very comforted that I found a wonderful person to live my life with. So actually, in a funny way, you know, it's turned out unexpectedly that finding a partner and kind of getting my life settled in that way has been a real, my parents really feel perfectly comfortable right now with my life, despite the fact that this is not what they really wanted for me.
Sandy, just one last question for you. We've been talking about parents' reactions to their children coming out. I'm wondering what your parents' reaction is to the fact that you're thinking of becoming a more Orthodox Jew. Because you grew up in a conservative family.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm still on my religious path, but I think my parents, you know, really, I mean, I have so many gay and lesbian cousins and actually so many people from the world which I grew up in who turned out to be lesbian or gay. But still, my parents couldn't talk about it, and they're not even from an Orthodox background. So for the first time, this gives them something to talk about in a way where they don't have to directly address my homosexuality. But this project has become a source of nachas, of pride for them. They can, you know, tell all their friends that he's going to be on NPR and listen and clip out newspaper articles and make scrapbooks.
And they come to so many screenings and they're like the parents of the film. It's like they've adopted everyone who's in the film. They're such wonderful people.
They're really, really sweet. And they're taking a lot of pride from the impact the film is having. You know, in the Jewish world and how much it's helping people.
You know, the straight couple friends of mine in London were at a screening that we did quite recently, and they came out of the film both teary-eyed, turned to each other with exactly the same thought and said, "We will never reject our children for any reason." And they held each other and wept. So this film is not really only about gay people or only about Orthodox Jews. In some large measure, it really is also about the terms of belonging and the responsibility of parents to love their children, you know, in a way that does not limit their children's ability to kind of grow into individual people. And it's really actually having that effect on lots of people. So we're really, really gratified.
I want to thank you all for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You.
Sandy Dabowski directed the film Trembling Before God. Rabbi Steven Greenberg is the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi. Michelle Miller is a lesbian from a Hasidic family. The film is now playing in several cities, including New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Washington, D.C. It will open in more cities over the next few weeks. Coming up, the author of a new guidebook to the Salt Lake City Olympic Winter Games. This is Fresh Air. After covering the Olympics 7 times for his newspaper, The Deseret News, Lee Benson is writing about the Winter Games coming to his hometown, Salt Lake City. The Games start February 8th. His book is called Lee Benson's Inside Guide to the Games. Benson is now a columnist for The Deseret News. He plans on writing a column a day during the Olympics. The Olympic organizers always knew they'd need tight security, but the security has become even tighter as a result of September's terrorist attacks. I asked Benson what he knows about the security plans.
I guess the budget has gone up over $300 million. The Attorney General, Ashcroft, has been here for quite a number of days just recently. We've also had in every organization with every acronym you can think of, FBI, CIA, and it's just ever-present now. I saw a National Guardsman yesterday with a rifle on his back, guarding a parking lot on the west side of Salt Lake City with about four cars in it. And this is well before the games begin. So it has become the omnipresent issue of the Winter Games.
What other signs of security are you already seeing, like barricades in the streets, razor barbed wire?
There, I haven't seen any razor barbed wire, but I have. You do see the barricades going up on the street, although that's a bit misleading because all Olympics shut down streets and allow for tents to be put up in different Olympic venues. But, for instance, I live very near the Olympic Park where the jumping and the bobsled luge and skeleton races will take place. In my neighborhood now, I can't walk where I once was able to walk. So I come around the corner where I could just loop right around the Olympic Park, and now there is a fence that's about 10 feet high and a guard that is there around the clock.
Now, I understand that in addition to things like fighter jets in the skies during the Olympics, there's going to be around 3,000 closed-circuit TV cameras in place around the city for security reasons. What do you know about those closed-circuit TV cameras and how they're going to be used and what people's concerns are about that?
Well, I know a little bit about that, probably more than I should, but I have talked to a few individuals, and they've told me that, for instance, on Park City Main Street, which will be a huge gathering point for the Olympics, there are video cameras lining the entire street. The freeway that connects Park City, it's a mountain venues with Salt Lake City, the hub of the Olympics, that's I-80, and it has in the hundreds of cameras that are along that freeway. So every inch of the freeway between Park City and Salt Lake City is under video surveillance. That will be really good for transportation, hopefully, but it will also be able to pinpoint any problems or potential problems.
Now, has Salt Lake recovered from the bribery scandal, the charges that officials offered more than $1 million in bribes in order to bring the games to Salt Lake?
I'm not sure Salt Lake will ever recover from that so-called bribery scandal because we are such a guilt-ridden people. Maybe that's not that unusual, but I think that you go back in the history of that scandal, and which was broken by NPR, by the way, and Howard Berkus, who is a crack reporter here and an excellent journalist, and I really think that it was his work that brought it to the attention of the world. Yes, there was a lot of excessive bidding that went on. People were given plastic surgery and dental treatment and shopping excursions to Walmart. I mean, we really threw it out to them, but at the end, there were only about $1 million worth of gifts and inducements, which pretty much parallels other cities, but there were a lot of people in Salt Lake when they found out we'd given anything, kind of blew the whistle on ourselves, and I think that's the case of our culture. So the scandal is kind of a self-created thing, and I think it will remain for a long time. Will it cast a shadow on the games? Luckily, I don't think much, because the case has been dismissed by a federal judge. It's now on appeal at the Court of Appeals. But as we all know, these things take a lot of time, and it could be 12 months to 18 months before anything, if anything, is done on that case.
What are the most anticipated events at the Winter Games?
Oh, the most anticipated events at the Winter Games, you know, what it's turned out to be, and this is kind of ironic, but they determined that they would have a free ticket for these games, and that would be to the Medals Plaza with spectator seating of 20,000 smack in the middle of Salt Lake City, right across from where the figure skating will be held and where the Jazz play when it's not the Olympics, right? So that seemed like a great idea to get the common person into an event, even if they couldn't afford a ticket. And then somebody decided, we're going to have this great entertainment. We're going to have Sheryl Crow. We're going to have Dave Matthews. We're going to have Brooks and Dunn, all these great acts, and we're going to have them perform on this stage before they award the Olympic medals. And so now that's become the hottest ticket in town. They're scalping those tickets on eBay that were free for, in excess of $100.
Are there any new sporting events that will be held at the Winter Olympics this year?
Yes, there. Well, Yes and no. The skeleton, which is like riding down on a sled face first, that's an event that hasn't been held in the Olympics except for at a special run in St. Moritz, Switzerland, in 1928, 1948, when the Olympics were there, it was held. And otherwise, it hasn't been an Olympic event. Salt Lake is going to have skeleton racing, and then presumably that it will be an Olympic sport from now on.
It's actually an arcane but pretty incredible sport where you're riding flat on your stomach on this sled that's really close to the ground. I think your chin is about 2 inches off the ground when you're riding on this. And the average, I think, is like 80 miles an hour. Sounds really intense.
It's very intense. The skeleton track record over at Olympic Park is actually just a tad over 90. That's top speed, 90 miles an hour. And your chin is a couple of inches off the ground when you start. They say that there isn't a skeleton racer alive who can keep it up off the ice the entire run. So they have their chin very well padded, because about half or three quarters of the way down, you start bouncing off the ice. Why anyone wants to do that one is a bit beyond me, but it'll be a great event.
Now, I imagine that, you know, since you wrote this guide to the Winter Games, that the two questions you're asked the most by people out of town, that the questions would be, where should I eat, and is it true that Mormons have lots of wives?
Right. In fact, I looked forward, as a Mormon myself, I looked forward to writing a couple of sections about Mormon culture and who we are, because you know when the world descends on Utah, they're going to be interested in this polygamy question about more than one wife. And so I know single-handedly I'm not going to stem that tide, but it's a very small part of our culture here, and it definitely is not a part of the Mormon church. If you practice polygamy, if you have more than one wife in the Mormon church, then you're excommunicated. And I think that's a good thing, at least to say. It still will be a big media issue when the Olympics come, I'm sure.
Well, the Olympics is probably a big issue for the Mormon church, because since I think it's about 65% of the population in Utah is Mormon, or at least in Salt Lake, you know, there's going to be a lot of press attention on the church. The church is known for its proselytizing, but the church president has asked Mormons not to proselytize to Olympic visitors, not to hand out the Book of Mormon. Can you talk a little bit about what's been happening behind the scenes in the Mormon church in preparation for the Olympics?
Well, I sure am not an official spokesman for the Mormon church, but I can say that the president of the church, the prophet Gordon B. Hinckley, has cautioned us to not be obnoxious. And I think that, of course, Christianity is a missionary religion, and there will be always missionary efforts by Christians, I suppose, or at least most denominations. And the church is, I know that they have remodeled both of their visitors' centers on Temple Square, and there will be a concerted effort to put our best foot forward and to present the message of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But beyond that, I think the goal here by the church is to be subtle and to just present that here we are, this is where we live. 69% of the state, as you suggested, is Mormon. In Salt Lake City, it's 59%. There are places such as Provo, where some of the Olympic hockey will be held, that is as high as 91% Mormon. So in effect, people just coming here will be able to be immersed in Mormonism without having to be hit over the head by it.
Now, this suggestion that Mormons not proselytize during the Olympics, was that considered controversial?
No, I don't think so. Generally, when you're an active member of the Mormon Church and the prophet says something, there doesn't tend to be a whole lot of controversy. Just because of the way the church is oriented. So, no, you didn't hear a lot of grumbling. In fact, some people probably sighed relief, because now they don't have to go out and have guilt about how many people they're supposed to tell about the Book of Mormon.
My guest is Lee Benson, author of A New Guide to Salt Lake City and the Olympic Winter Games. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lee Benson. He's a columnist for the Deseret News in Salt Lake City and author of A New Guide to Salt Lake and the Olympic Winter Games. Now, for people who are visiting Salt Lake, are there any unusual regulations pertaining to the purchase or consumption of alcohol?
The alcohol laws, like polygamy, will, I assume, receive a lot of attention because there are laws in the state that aren't common, I guess, everywhere else. They aren't as rigid as people think, I suppose. There are certainly no dry areas in Salt Lake City or in Utah, but there are some rules I guess people will have to get used to. You can't have a drink in a restaurant in Salt Lake City or in Utah unless you also have some food with it. So you have to come in and order something to eat before you can order a drink. And then the other kind of unique rule here is that you can't get an alcohol list unless you ask for it. In other words, they don't just bring it to your table like the food menu.
What's the rationale for having to order food when you order a drink? Is that for each drink you have to order more food, or just like in order to get any drinks you have to order one item of food?
I think it's one item of food, and then you can go ahead and order drinks, but you can't order two drinks at once. You have to finish one before you start the other. And I chuckle because it's foreign to me, and I learned all this to put it in my guidebook, but I'd lived here my whole life. And I think in a way that kind of reflects the culture here in Salt Lake and in Utah. There are some of us who don't drink, who these laws just, we don't think about them because they don't apply. And then you have to, when you think about the whole world coming and everything, it makes you stop and think and be a bit more sensitive to people who these do matter to.
Now, being from Salt Lake, I'm sure you're going to feel very protective of your hometown when people from around the world converge on it. But also being a journalist who's covered 7 Olympic Games, you know what it's like to be the outsider coming to the Olympics. So do you think that'll give you more empathy and more of an understanding for the people outside coming to Salt Lake?
I would love to find a journalist who has been in the boat I've been in a couple of games, wandering around the main media center and be able to go over, put my arm around him and say, hey, here, let me help you out. I being on the inside is a nice, comfortable feeling for a change. And I do know the feeling of going to a place that is totally foreign and you just lost. So I'm going to look for those people with the deer in the headlight looks and see if I can't help them out. I probably will find one or two. I'm sure there will be many, just like myself. I remember in Albertville, France, I hadn't a clue the first week that I was there, and it took a lot of work to find out where I was going, what I was doing.
Well, Lee Benson, thank you very much for talking with us, and I hope you have some time to actually enjoy the Olympics.
This time, probably more than ever, sleep in my own bed and only have to do, you know how it is, you go to an Olympics elsewhere and the editor says, oh yeah, do this sidebar and find this person and do a story. And this time we've got 42 people credentialed at our newspaper to cover the Olympics, so I'll have it pretty easy.
Lee Benson is a columnist for the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. His new book is called Lee Benson's Guide to the Games. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. You may have noticed that ABC is showing James Bond movies Saturday nights. Dr. No was on this past weekend. We'll close with Dr. Yes from the band Sex Mob and their CD Sex Mob Does Bond.
Tapes and transcripts of most Fresh Air programs are available by calling 877-21-FRESH or 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands by Susan Carroll McCarthy, a novel set in Florida during the Civil Rights Movement. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This Wednesday marks the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the day British paratroopers opened fire on Catholic demonstrators in Northern Ireland, killing 13. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson. They investigated the incident in 1972 for the Sunday Times of London. They now have a book about Bloody Sunday. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.